Love Bristol.
Love
BCFM 93.2.
I think the genius of people who work in that art, espionage, and it is an art, not a science, in my judgment, is they have an ability to absorb knowledge very quickly, to gather information, analyze that information, interpret that information, and form a judgment in a way which most of us don't.
In wartime, Churchill said, the truth was so precious it had to be surrounded by a bodyguard of lies. Bill Stevenson said, nothing deceives like a document.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Israel on the offensive in Syria and Gaza despite not having a properly constituted government. Is it simply a case of the military like a weak government because they can then do exactly what they like? And a coup in Bolivia plays out differently to the Venezuelan elections last year, doesn't it? And indigenous rights president Evo Morales has to flee the country. He's now in Mexico. But who's now in charge? There's definitely far-right fascist elements in there. And was this coup arranged by the United States? If so, what are they doing dealing with Bolivian fascists? Plus, in our World War II series and the Battle of Arnhem, questions are answered by the founding Deputy Director General of the United Nations, who miraculously is still alive. He was actually involved in the Battle of Arnhem, but he was booted out, an intelligence officer booted out 2 days before it started. Sacked by some of those incompetent generals behind that disaster. Because he was right. He didn't want to hear what he had to say. Sir Brian Urquhart. Plus Bormann in the bunker. And the end of the war at the writing of Adolf Hitler's will. Stuffed into Martin Bormann's pocket. And with it, a bank account containing at least $1 billion takes off from the Führer bunker on the 1st of May, 1945. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM, Tuesday at noon this week, a treatment for Alzheimer's here in Bristol, which is apparently bringing one sufferer back from the brink. Some definite results. By the careful use of diet, mental stimulation, and some good old TLC. Contrast that with some tales of woe, victims of Lloyds Bank's Castle Park branch, the bait and switch technique they use. You can lose everything through the devil in the detail of an innocent looking new loan contract they switch you onto. You can listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday or download that show right now from dialectradio.co.uk. But we better start, Martin, with the Israeli action in Gaza and in Syria over the last few days. The political background to this is a bit complicated, is it? They're now looking at potentially another general election in Israel because it's been so inconclusive, the previous ones.
Yeah, and at the same time, the securocrats who run the Israeli state, you know, the military and so on, they've got their own agenda, and that they, you know, the elections are in a sense a sideshow because they've got their own ongoing strategies for doing various things. So obviously they killed this Islamic Jihad person, and then they've killed loads of people over the last week in Gaza. No Israelis have been killed at all, and most of them, you know, quite a large proportion of them children who clearly are not combatants.
Israel's temporary security minister, this is in the New Arab, Al Arabi, Naftali Bennett has threatened yet more Palestinian leaders will be killed after the killing of an Islamic jihad leader in the besieged Gaza Strip. The far-right Naftali Bennett on Wednesday morning sent a threat to Palestinian officials as Israel's military continues to bomb civilians in Gaza. Well, there's been a ceasefire since then, but this morning he said, "We send a clear message to all our enemies on all fronts. Whoever plans to target us in the daytime will never be safe for the night to pass," he said. Despite the continuation of bloodshed and rise in Palestinian deaths, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu claimed Wednesday that Israel is not looking to escalate the deadly violence. So he's there really saying that it's not enough for you to have actually attacked Israel, but if you're planning to attack Israel, we may decide to assassinate you.
Well, I mean, this has been their policy all along. I don't think there's much change there. But of course, the other side could equally say, right, well, when we come round to your house in the middle of the night and blow your brains out, don't go crying to your mummy.
So what about the whole ceasefire that's now transpired? That's at least good, but I mean, the end result is, of course, another, you know, many, many more Palestinians killed than the Israelis in this.
Well, that's right. Strike. I mean, ultimately, of course, what this could turn into is a fight between the Syrian army backed by the Russians and the IDF backed by the Americans. And that, then, of course, we would be dragged in.
One of the best sources, sources of this, usually, generally, is Al Jazeera. We don't really seem to get such good coverage in this part of the world of those issues. Why might that be?
Well, Al Jazeera is relatively high quality stuff, but of course it's basically based in Qatar, and therefore it generally reflects the position of the Qatari government. So, for example, they supported the jihadi uprising in Syria until they started to they started to fall out with the Saudis. I think with all of these international,
is it fair to say that
you've got to take what they say.
The Israelis have been putting pressure on Qatar and on Al Jazeera to toe the line, because they broadcast this, I think it's called The Lobby. It was a program about the way the Israeli government is really flexing its muscles, spending vast amounts of money in the UK, for example.
Well, the one in the UK was shown, and of course it showed that the Israeli embassy and a Mossad officer were talking to a former Labour MP, saying that we've got £1 million to spend in the Labour Party to get the results we want. Of course, that money isn't really Israeli money, because the Israeli state depends upon the US taxpayer. So US taxpayers are paying for the Israelis to subvert the policy of the British Labour Party, and of course that is interference in our elections by any definition.
It's just not about the Labour Party, is it?
They also said they're going to take down Alan Duncan because he was a Tory minister at the time, which they didn't like, and it was all captured on film by the Al Jazeera sting. And then the same people...
This is the sort of thing the BBC used to
It's funny you should mention the BBC, because the same people who were caught out in that sting as being working for the Israeli embassy were then paraded on a panorama programme put out by John Ware as a producer, saying that they'd been discriminated against in the Labour Party for being Jews, etc. But we've also got them on the record on Al Jazeera, basically cooperating with the Israeli embassy to subvert Labour policy, and yet they complain that they're being discriminated against. Some mistake here, surely.
So 8 family members were killed, 12 critical in the Israeli raids, 3 adults and 5 children were killed in attacks, while 12 other Palestinian family members are in a critical condition yesterday. Hundreds of Palestinians carrying black Islamic Jihad flags gathered at Al-Mujahideen Mosque in central Gaza on Thursday to attend more funeral prayers. 8 members of the Abu Malhous family. So who are Islamic Jihad? If you were to believe most of the English language press, they are a terrorist organization.
Yeah, and of course the same Islamic Jihad or affiliated organizations fighting in Syria are for freedom, and we should support them to get rid of the evil Assad. But of course in Gaza they're evil terrorists with black flags.
But I thought
when they do it in Syria, Hamas is another story. But their allies inside Syria are our allies, and we supply them with weaponry to kill Syrian soldiers, because that's fighting for freedom.
So are they potentially using some of that weaponry and smuggling it into Palestine, into Gaza?
What Al-Fatah would say about Hamas, and Hamas was originally created by the Israelis. Sheikh Yassin was very much their protege.
He was assassinated by an Israeli hellfire missile.
But when he started off, they encouraged him as a way of undermining Fatah. And I would see Islamic Jihad performing pretty much the same function in relation to Hamas. And of course, as the point I'm making is that these kind of Islamic extremists are regarded as freedom fighters in Syria and reprehensible terrorists in Gaza, but they're exactly the same kind of people. And of course, Al-Qaeda is still in control of Idlib province, and we're going on how terrible it is for the Syrian army to get rid of Al-Qaeda from Idlib province.
Meanwhile,
in Gaza, they're the enemy and we're going to bomb them.
Gaza ceasefire is under pressure tonight after renewed Israeli air attacks, apparently. So that's just the latest on Al Jazeera on Gaza.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously the Middle East as a whole is teetering on the brink of catastrophe, potentially. And, of course, you had Boris Johnson last week saying that Corbyn would support Iran rather than the US. And, of course, it's the British that seized the Iranian tanker completely illegally, which then led to a potential for a war.
These attacks were this morning, so it doesn't sound like a ceasefire if Israel is still doing air attacks.
Well, this is it. The ceasefires come and go, and there are ceasefires by the different groups as well. Hamas have offered the Israelis what they call a hudna, which is a long-run ceasefire. You stop killing us, we'll stop killing you, and let's negotiate, but we're not recognising Israel. There's no reason why you should recognise an entity which is trying to destroy, which won't recognise you. And all they say, well, they've got to recognise the state of Israel. Their answer is, no, they don't. Ultimately, they might, if you negotiate with them, but they're not going to give that away in the first negotiation. We're prepared to stop killing you if you stop killing us. But ultimately, we're going to war here. And as Boris Johnson rightly said, you know, we're prepared to fight Iran to keep the Americans and Israelis happy. People are going to think about that when they come to vote on December the 12th, haven't they?
Israeli forces kill top Islamic Jihad commander in Gaza air raid. So the killing of Baha Abu al-Attar, I think this was on Tuesday in Gaza, we're cycling back a little bit here, comes as Palestinian group says its political leader was also targeted in Damascus. So Islamic Jihad, separately on Tuesday, Syrian state media says Israel launched a missile attack targeting the home of Islamic Jihad official in the Syrian capital, killing his son and granddaughter, but missing him. A Syrian official said Israeli fighter jets fired 3 missiles toward Damascus, one of which was intercepted, while the other 2 struck the home of Islamic Jihad political leader Akram al-Ajouri in Meza, a western district of the city. So the Israelis are sort of basically carrying out what we used to expect from, I suppose it was Obama, wasn't it? It was doing the whole kill list on a Wednesday, wasn't it? I think they're saying, well, we can just kill anyone we want in the Middle East.
If you put the boot on the other foot, some Israeli politicians are extremely right-wing. So extremely right-wing that you could say, well, in actual fact, they're fascists. So would it be okay to go and kill their grandchildren? Because that's what you're ultimately saying. When you do stuff like that, you're saying that that's okay. But if people do it to you, you scream blue murder and say that's terrorism.
And what about,
in actual fact, it's warfare. Horrible, isn't it?
And what about Lebanon? Because there's been protests, a lot of protests in Lebanon. We've been covering on and off over the last few weeks, right in the middle of all of this.
Well, the Middle East is potentially being destabilised majorly by the Israelis and the Western powers. But what's stabilising it is the victory of the Syrian Arab army in Syria, the very professional intervention that the Russians have carried out in that country, compared to the mess that we made in Iraq, where the British army were kicked unceremoniously out of Basra by the local boys whose fathers and uncles and cousins had all been tortured by Saddam Hussein, and they said, we don't want the British army here, and they killed a few of our guys and we ran away with the tail between our legs. Meanwhile, in Syria, the Russians are regarded as heroes. There's a big difference, isn't there?
Tonight, Lebanese protesters are rejecting another elite prime minister candidate. Activists are saying business tycoon, former Tripoli MP Mohamed Safadi is emblematic of the system they want to bring down. So they're now saying, although one prime minister has gone, the protesters are saying the new one that's come along is not good enough.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are obviously, we're talking about Lebanon now, presumably.
Yeah.
It's hard to know from outside exactly what's going on. There are clearly, obviously, economic reasons for these kind of protests. But you've also got to realise that outside powers are stirring the pot. So, you know, the war in Syria began with protests supposedly for democracy, which then immediately degenerated into Islamic extremists killing police officers and non-Sunni citizens. And in Lebanon, they had a terrible civil war, which was eventually resolved by all sides kind of drawing back and agreeing to kind of share
power. It looks
power.
Like that power-sharing arrangement is breaking down now.
That's the danger.
Due to popular protests.
Yeah, so. but the danger with the popular protest is people may want a better life and all the rest of it, and they're often young people who haven't lived through the civil war. But what may happen as a result of this is you just set the clock ticking towards another showdown between the various sectarian groups which make up the population. And the real unfairness in Lebanon is that the Christian minority continue to dominate the banks, the civil service, the army, and the majority Muslim population, which is split between the Sunni and the Shia, don't really get a look in. So that's the problem with having a kind of sectarian-based system. But of course, if there was a one-person, one-vote democratic system, the Christians would lose, and they wouldn't have any same power at all. So, you know, people should be careful what they wish for. Often situations are not perfect, but if you try and change them without thinking through what you're trying to do, you end up with a worse situation, as happened in Syria, where, you know, people who wanted a democracy ended up with a civil war loads of jihadis coming in from all over the world.
Martin, people like Andrei Vilcek are saying, for years I was warning that the country governed by corrupt indifferent elites could not hold together indefinitely. He's saying, I was warning this was going to happen.
Yeah, well, you've also got to understand that the whole creation of the country of Lebanon was done by the French, because they were driven out of Syria in an uprising, and they kept Lebanon separated from the rest of Syria because they thought they could keep control of it by using manipulation of different social, and religious groups. So that the existence of a country called Lebanon, you see, ultimately what happens in wars is that countries get destroyed and new countries are created.
Okay, the big news of the week really is Bolivia, isn't it, though? Evo Morales wins an election. But the head of the army says, hang on a minute, there's too many protests, you're going to have to leave. And he agrees. He hasn't got a lot of choice, really. If the head of the army is saying, you've got to go, yeah. Evo Morales, he's not got much of a choice. I mean, obviously, we've got to contrast this with what happened last year up in Venezuela. Very, yeah. Very different. And it's whether the army is loyal to the people, whether they're loyal to the president, or whether they're loyal to an outside power.
Well, in Venezuela, of course, Chavez was a paratroops colonel, and he was... He's the previous president, and of course he was involved, like most Latin American armies, they've got nobody to fight apart from their own people, basically, and they're all trained at the School of the Americas in Fort Benning in Georgia in torture techniques and all the rest of it, and there are some military officers in Latin America, like General Velasco in Peru in the 1960s, Carlos Prats in Chile, who was assassinated by the Americans, basically. Why they were unable to carry out a coup in Venezuela is because after the attempted coup against Chavez many years ago, Chavez cleaned out all the dead wood. So he made sure that the leadership of the Venezuelan army, and don't forget he's an army officer himself, were the right people, the people they wanted.
He's a bit of an Eisenhower character, actually.
Well, yeah, basically that's the difference.
You've got to know the way the army operates.
What you've got in Bolivia is that the army, which used to be a military dictatorship in Bolivia, and we're coming to the Second World War stuff in a minute, but Klaus Barbie went to Bolivia as a subcontractor to the CIA to teach the Bolivian army how to torture people, and that's how Bolivia used to be run. And Evo Morales has actually improved the conditions. He's himself an indigenous farmer, very different from the other Latin American leaders who tend to be from the wealthy classes. And
so who is this Jeanine Añez?
Well, you may ask, because in actual fact, most people in Bolivia haven't heard of her.
She was the top-ranking, apparently, Senate opposition official when Morales resigned on Sunday.
Yeah, but most people, the same thing happened with Guaido in Venezuela when the outside world declared him the president, and most people in Venezuela have never even heard of him, and he never even stood for president, and nor has this woman. What's happening here is that what they ought to do now, why Morales has gone to Mexico, because of course the Mexican government is left-wing and therefore he's gone there, he's saying, well, okay, let's have a second round election with me on the ballot.
We haven't really seen much commentary in this part of the world that it's actually an indigenous leader that's been replaced by a white leader.
No, and of course you've got Dominic Raab and the Tories going on about, isn't it disgraceful that Jeremy Corbyn is supporting Morales, the dictator who's just been overthrown by the people in Bolivia. That just shows how out of touch with the reality those people are.
What about this far-right alliance that's over there? I mean, this is obviously quite concerning, isn't it? It looks like the Americans have actually been working with the far-right over there. Just to name a few names, we're talking about the leader, Luis Fernando Camacho. He's a far-right multimillionaire who arose from the fascist movements in the Santa Cruz region of Bolivia, where the US has encouraged separatism. He's courted support from Colombia, Brazil, and the Venezuelan opposition. So a lot of people from the Venezuelan opposition have been involved in what's been going on in Bolivia. Plus, of course, they've got the biggest border, I believe, in Bolivia is with Brazil, which of course now is a very, very far right country.
Yeah.
Where we believe, actually, by the way, Ghislaine Maxwell is successfully being squirreled away, a bit like a Nazi after World War II.
Well, I mean, as you say, Tony, we shouldn't be surprised. I mean, the US has been in cahoots with far-right groups in Latin America for years and years and years and years and years. So they're just reverting to type here. Don't forget there was a military dictatorship in Bolivia, which was super pro-American, and Hugo Banza, who used to head it up, General Hugo Banza, it was based on cocaine. There was no doubt about it. They were selling massive amounts of cocaine, just as the Iran-Contra affair demonstrated in the 1980s into the United States. And they work with very far-right groups. There's an ex-Croatian guy whose name I've forgotten, who's in Bolivia. And, of course, he fled to Bolivia from Croatia, or his family did, at the end of the war, because it was on the rat lines that the Vatican and others helped to set up to rescue the Nazis, and they were all sent to Latin America to work with the military, and the CIA were all very knowledgeable about it because they orchestrated it all. So the idea that the Americans go around the world basically pushing democracy, and then then it's a bit shocking that they're working with some far-right fascist paramilitaries, is simply wrong. They've been working with fascist far-right paramilitaries forever.
It's almost like we're getting to the Berlin 1945 bunker before our time here, Martin. We'll be coming to that a bit more in a minute. But with Luis Fernando Camacho stormed into Bolivia's abandoned presidential palace this week in the hours after President Evo Morales' sudden resignation, he revealed to the world a side of the country that stood at stark odds, apparently, with the plurinational spirit its deposed socialist and indigenous leader had put forward. With a Bible in one hand and a national flag in the other, Camacho bowed his head in prayer above the presidential seal, fulfilling his vow to purge his country's native heritage from government and return God to the burned place. Now, this is even more sinister, isn't it, that we've got the far right here using the Bible in order to try and say, well, actually, what we're doing is for God, and those evil indigenous people, you know, come from some kind of, backward pagan world.
Well, I mean, the indigenous themselves are overwhelmingly Catholic. I think he's probably a Protestant. And, of course, the liberation theologians in Latin America for years have been on the side of the people. But Oscar Romero was assassinated while he gave mass in San Salvador.
So who is this guy? I mean, the interesting question, I'll put a link up to this article in the Grey Zone on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But this guy, Camacho, he stepped apparently in. He's a powerful multimillionaire named in the Panama Papers, an ultra-conservative, big inverted commas, Christian fundamentalist groomed by a fascist paramilitary notorious for its racist violence with a base in Bolivia's wealthy separatist region of Santa Cruz. And this is looking really nasty here, that these guys have been sitting there sort of getting ready to pounce and as soon as Morales taken his palace over.
They've burned a lot of people have been attacked and killed and lots of stuff have been burned down.
So why are the army saying, yes, Morales has got to go, when this is the obvious answer, is there's going to be potentially a civil war in Bolivia?
Well, there will be. I think what's going to happen is just like it's happened with Lenin Moreno, who's supposedly of the left in Ecuador, but he's moved to the right.
I mean, what we seem to be looking
at... And there's been a mass uprising. There's been a mass uprising in Chile, I think, here in Chile today, that they've agreed that there's going to be a constitutional referendum. Lula has been released from prison in Brazil. What's happening in Latin America is the right wing and the left wing are going to war with each other, because that's ultimately the fruit of the collapse of the the Western financial system in 2008.
Well, in Chile, they've just announced that they are going to have there's going to be a referendum on the constitution. Chile's announced today it will hold a referendum on the country's constitution following weeks of anti-government protests. They're saying basically this constitution we're living under now was written by Pinochet. We've had enough.
Yes, and of course, lots of people have died. They've been killed by the police and the army. And, of course, lots of people in Bolivia have been killed, but not by the police and the army. The police and the army have killed Morales' supporters. And, of course, it was in 1967, that was where, in Bolivia, was where Che Guevara was assassinated by, people working with the Americans. And ultimately, the Cubans, actually, they got their revenge. The guy that had assassinated Che Guevara was going blind. He was a soldier who actually pulled the trigger, and Cuban doctors restored his sight. That was their punishment for killing their hero.
So is it safe to visit South America? That's one of the questions the Telegraph is asking. Latest travel advice for Bolivia, Chile, Argentina and Ecuador, all four countries suffering with quite a lot of sort of fighting on the streets, that sort of thing, and particularly obviously Bolivia. At the end of the day, this is Americom, surely. This is a branch of the Pentagon in Florida, near Fort Lauderdale, in Florida, Martin, which is where they manage this sort of thing. We're talking about a kind of covert operations throughout South America, throughout. And, of course, this is not lost on most ordinary indigenous or otherwise switched-on South Americans. They know the Americans are interfering, and they have been ever since the end of the Second World War at the very least.
And before. Yeah. And before. I mean, the unequal social structure in that part of the world has been backed up by their North American allies for years and years and years, and there was some hope after the lost decade of the 1980s. Morales, if you actually look at the figures, they had massive economic growth. Most of the benefits went to the poorest people, and they were doing really well. But of course, that can't be allowed because everybody's going to want that, aren't they? We've got to put a stop to this before it gets out of hand. And of course, Trump immediately tweets, "Isn't this great that we've done all of this?" Blah blah blah. And of course, the Tories over here immediately jump onto the bandwagon. Isn't it fantastic that this evil Indian president has been removed so that the fascists can kill people in freedom?
It sounds to me like one of the desk officers at Americom. In Florida, has been chatting to his neighbour on the opposite side of the open plan office because Bolivia's interim leader has now recognised Juan Guaido as the leader of Venezuela.
Yeah, well, that's clearly what's going on. Yeah, but when Juan Guaido doesn't have the army behind him and Maduro is still in power. And, of course, there's just been an election in Argentina which the left have won. In Chile, it looks as if they can carry on this process, the left will win there. Lula is out of prison now, which means that Bolsonaro's got a serious opponent. In Mexico, the left have won the first election for maybe 50 years.
But isn't all this a recipe for chaos in South America, actually?
Well, no, what's happening is a struggle, a class struggle, if you like, between the wealthy, well-connected elites and the disenfranchised majority.
And the more these countries are destabilised and the more the chaos is on the streets, surely the elites, the banks, the Americans just rub their hands and say, this is what we wanted.
What they want is them in control. And if they get a situation where they've lost control, they bide their time and then they come in and they remove the people they don't like.
Okay, so here's a question for you. Would the US Pentagon rather have freedom in these countries and a democratically elected system, or would they rather have chaos?
They'd much rather have chaos. That's quite obvious from what's happening. And they're not being even-handed in any way. The OAS, which is run by the Americans, the Organization of African American States, immediately questioned the election that's just been held. Now, nobody disputes that Morales won the election. Yeah, he won. And it's a presidential election, so it's under first past the post, and he needed to get 40%. Or plus in order not to have a second round. But his party, the Movement for Socialism, still controls the Senate and still controls the Congress. But both of those have been dispersed by the military. So in other words, what we've got here is a military coup without any shadow of a doubt.
So the military
and the Western powers are backing that up because they'd far rather have a fascist military government in Bolivia than a free democracy because it's going to vote for things they don't
want.
Here
in the UK, of course, we've got the wonderful Veterans for Peace who turn up at the Cenotaph every Remembrance Sunday with their white poppies from the Peace Pledge Union because there's a lot of problems with the red poppies going down a way where they're now basically saying That they support the British troops in conflicts. Well, that's actually not really what they started off by doing. That the idea was that the Royal British Legion would try and end war, and they were campaigning also for veterans. But the veterans in this country are more and more going over to using the white poppies and joining things like Veterans for Peace, Martin, at the Cenotaph. And in the United States, something else is going on. Bring Our Troops Home movement takes their fight to end America's endless wars. And they've been at Capitol Hill this week. Veterans and state legislators from 26 states are pressing Congress to assert congressional responsibility for war powers and bring U.S. troops home. Veterans and state legislators, led by retired Army National Guard Sergeant Dan McKnight, have been in Washington on Veterans Day week to press members of Congress, and particularly to end the war in Afghanistan. They say this is specifically the one. You've just got to bring all of the troops back there. He's a military combat veteran who serves at Bring Our Troops Home. As US chairman, he's making the case for lawmakers to reevaluate US foreign policy from top to bottom, to de-emphasize military intervention, and particularly that in the Middle East.
Well, also, Tulsi Gabbard is still running for the Democratic nomination for president, and she, of course, served in Afghanistan, in Iraq. She's a medic, and I think she's a colonel in the National Guard, so she often campaigns in uniform, and she's been very, very strong about we've got to stop all these foreign wars. We're sick of it.
Another thing from the UK point of view, if you want, is the death this week of James Le Mesurier. Now, very peculiar, apparently fell off a roof or either committed suicide or got pushed. No one really knows. What do you make of this? He was the man who was the founder of the White Helmets and a former British Army officer from Sandhurst.
Yeah, well, I mean, what has actually happened to him, I wouldn't speculate. The official line is that he committed suicide. His wife was there. She says that there's no foul play, and that's what they're saying.
So apparently he had mental problems of some sort.
Well, he was apparently on medication of some sort. But, I mean, what's really interesting, and what I spoke about this week on Rush Today, was that Wikipedia, his Wikipedia article, on the day that he died, this whoever it is called
Philip Cross
carried out several changes to his Wikipedia profile on the day that he died, and it'd be interesting to see whether those changes to his profile took place before he fell from the balcony or after he fell from the balcony.
So anyway,
and if you're a police officer, you might start thinking about that.
So just a bit some more on the circumstances of James Le Mesurier's death. He went to hospital with high blood pressure just over 24 hours before he died and plunged to his death, says the housekeeper at his family home in Turkey. He was found dead at 5:30 a.m. on Monday, apparently after falling from a third floor ledge at his apartment. He'd spent the weekend at the family home on the island of Buyukada in Turkey, that he shared with his wife Emma Weinberg and his two young daughters. Their housekeeper said the British ex-army officer had been feeling unwell over the weekend. But who are the White Helmets? Because this is really, yeah. I mean, all this stuff about the detail of how he died is peripheral to the role he played in the Syrian so-called civil war.
Yeah, well, the White Helmets are effectively a propaganda operation which are aligned with Al-Qaeda and working with British and American intelligence. And
Hang on. No, they would turn up when there have been bomb attacks to help rescue people. That's not the same thing.
That's the story, but of course they only operate in rebel-controlled areas, and we've got loads of video footage of them basically carrying weaponry. And some of the video footage...
They might have to defend themselves against the rebels,
no,
mightn't they?
Well, no. Al-Baghdadi... You know, there's lots of evidence to suggest that they're embedded with the terrorists, effectively. And of course, they are embedded with the terrorists because the Western powers created the jihadi opposition inside Syria.
The Russians, there's a finger being pointed at the Russians. His death came a week after Russia called him a British spy for MI6.
Well, Maria Zakharova basically pointed out the obvious, that he was a spook, because he was a spook. There's no doubt about it. And the White Helmets aren't an indigenous movement that grew up inside Syria. They were created with foreign funds and foreign direction. And he was the mastermind. Yeah, he's not a Syrian, he's a British Army guy. He's retired from the British Army, but he still takes his money for... We pay for what he does, yeah? He's our employee. And he's not a Syrian, But he created the White Helmets, and the White Helmets, over time, the Swedish doctors pointed out that some of the stuff they were doing to these children that they were supposedly helping was actually possibly killing them. And it was nothing, a lot,
that sounds like a bit of a wild.
No, it's not wild, because don't forget, one of the things they've done is they've taken, at one stage, the Ghouta chemical weapons attack, that at the beginning, we think they took Alawite children that they captured, you know, non-Sunni children, killed them all, and then tried to blame it on the government. And they've been encouraged to do that by their handlers in MI6 and the CIA, who are criminal murderers.
Okay, well,
we've just been talking about Bolivia.
Going back to the more political situation, fascinating article I was reading through this week, the CIA, and this of course does bear on our elections here, the elections in the United States. The CIA has interfered with over 81 foreign elections in the past century, says one of the articles I was reading. I'll just see if I can find who the author is. But Martin, this whole idea of CIA interfering in elections is actually extremely well known. In Italy, for example, for decades after World War II, the CIA were trying to make sure they're keeping the communists out of power, and they interfered in those elections massively.
Yeah.
So what, I mean, what it starts to, I start to think, well, hang on a minute, all this stuff about Russia interfering in elections is only coming out there, and it's being manufactured, because what's happening is actually the CIA are the main people who are actually interfering in elections, and they're trying to bat away criticism before it even arrives.
Well, that's right. I mean, basically, they're accusing the Russians of doing what they've been doing for years and years and years and years and years. I mean, as Kissinger famously said, we can't let a country go communist because of the irresponsibility of its own people.
And that number of 81 elections doesn't even include military coups and regime change efforts following the election of candidates the US doesn't like, notably those in Iran, Guatemala, Chile. I mean, the list goes on and on, doesn't it?
It does, yes. So people say, oh, it's a banana republic. A banana republic is Guatemala, where the Albenz government was overthrown in the 1950s by the CIA. A military regime was put in power, which killed tens of thousands of people with torture and murder and all the rest of it. But they're our allies. That's what we do. We are the bad guys. And people get very fed up with it outside in the wider world.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Well, we now go to have a look at the Battle of Arnhem. And this is Questions, which amazingly is still alive. This is the chap who was the intelligence officer in the 1st Airborne Division in the run-up to the Battle of Arnhem. His name is Sir Brian Urquhart. And he also, Martin, took a great role after World War II in helping set up the first Congresses of the United Nations, becoming their assistant secretary general.
Well, that's interesting. Have we got some clips to listen to about this?
Oh, we can go straight to them if you'd like, which is actually, this is a clip from a DVD, and it's produced in London by the Polish community in London. The DVD is called Debt of Dishonour, and it's really about the way that the Polish were treated after the Battle of Arnhem, because they were basically scapegoated. But anyway, I thought we'd have a listen to, this is General John Brewinkiewicz, and he's reading Sir Brian Urquhart's answers to questions about the intelligence failures in the run-up to Arnhem, and his assessment, really, of the Polish role, because there's certainly a lot of people in the Polish community who are particularly irritated that even though it was the British generals that threw the battle, they blamed the Poles.
Decisions were not willing to face the implications of the intelligence that we gave them. In my case, I strongly disagreed on matters like the drop zones being far too far from the bridge, the importance of the 9th and 10th SS Panzer Divisions, and the Royal Air Force's insistence in only having one sortie on D-Day, on the first day of the operation. I thought that the idea that the Germans were not strong enough to oppose Market Garden was dangerous nonsense. I believe that the plan, therefore, required serious high-level reassessment in view of the latest developments. I was dismissed by General Browning on the 15th of September, 2 days before the operation began, apparently for nervous strain.
When and where did you return onto the battlefield?
I was ordered to resume my post in the headquarters of the Airborne Corps in Nijmegen on the 23rd of September. I thought that General Sosabowski was a very fine fighting soldier who was confronted suddenly with an unusual and unforeseen danger, which he handled with skill and great courage.
Could you please tell us what were the most important lessons learned from the Operation Market Garden?
I think the most important lesson is probably the oldest one. Commanders must always be frank and honest, especially with themselves. Those with important direct responsibilities should not be saddled by more senior commanders with orders which they believe to be fundamentally unsound. I did not know of the details of General Sosabowski's treatment by Browning and Montgomery and the War Office until much later, when I was about to go on the annual pilgrimage to Arnhem in 2006. I made a broadcast on this subject on Netherlands Radio on my way to Arnhem because I was indignant that such charges could stand unchallenged by history, and I felt that something must be done to right the wrong that had been done to a courageous man and a fine soldier. I regret that so far the British government has not followed the example of the Dutch government in recognising the service and sacrifice of General Sosabowski and his brigade at Arnhem.
General John Drewinkiewicz complimented Sir Brian Urquhart's account of Arnhem 1944.
So that was from the video, the DVD, and it's called Debt of Dishonour. It was produced in 2013. And that was the Polish General John Brewinkiewicz reading the answers by Sir Brian Urquhart, who was there at the battle. Martin, this is actually quite significant, isn't it? The way that the Dutch have said, look, this attack... Actually, it was an attack, wasn't it, really, on the Polish after the battle. It's simply not acceptable. We apologise for it, but the British won't. And one of the interesting things is that the guy who was responsible for that attack on the Poles and for the failures at Arnhem is a guy called General Boy Browning, who was, by the way, married to Daphne du Maurier, the writer. But Browning then became very close to the Duke of Edinburgh running his finances after the war. One of the main obstacles in actually getting this apology, apparently, according to the polls, is the Duke of Edinburgh himself, who's he doesn't want his former employee's name to be blackened. And so this apology apparently can't go ahead.
Well, it is extraordinary, isn't it? You'd have thought, why would the British want to dump all the failures at Arnhem on the Poles?
75 years afterwards, yeah. Still, yeah. They can't get this apology.
Well, that's possibly because there's more to the whole battle than meets the eye, as you have been researching over many years, Tony. It's quite possible that the Germans had access to the order of battle of the British coming through King Kong, the spy that they'd infiltrated into the British and Allied structures, but also because there was deals possibly being done with the Germans, which of course is the substance of your investigation.
Well, this is the key thing, really. In August 1944, there was something called the Red House meeting in Strasbourg, revealed by Paul Manning, the former US CBS wartime journalist, broadcaster, and that meeting really was the beginning of a complete opening of the discussions between Martin Bormann and the senior industrialists in Nazi Germany and the West, including things like making sure that technology came to the West, that expertise, that scientists came to the West and to the Allies. And yet the war was still going on at that stage, Martin.
Yeah, well, don't forget they're already planning ahead. The war's going to end. That's why they had the meeting at the Red House, the top Nazis and industrialists, because they knew they were going to lose, and they decided it was time to open negotiations. But they'd already been negotiating with the British, according to Creighton Davis or John Ainsworth Davis in the book Op JB. And I think the other thing that's absolutely blindingly obvious, we were talking about Bolivia earlier, Klaus Barbie was basically rescued. He was the butcher of Lyon. The French always wanted to put him on trial. Eventually they did, but he was allowed to escape to Latin America along with lots of others, and then were put to use by the CIA keeping the local population down. And of course, once the war was over, they were discussing, you know, the West had atomic weapons that the Soviet Union didn't. There was serious discussion, and Churchill was one of the ones saying, well, why don't we just nuke them now.
Well, of course, this is a key. The key thing here, what we were talking about with the Battle of Arnhem at Market Garden, was that the British failure in that battle, and the Americans did an amazing job, but the British just didn't seem to want to go to Arnhem, even though they had 15 hours to get there before the Arnhem Bridge collapsed, was because, well, two things really. One was they wanted to give the Nazis more time to squirrel the wealth away so that they could then receive it, but also so that the Russians would have to do most of the fighting, and of course they did.
Yeah,
most of the fighting to Berlin.
That's right.
In fact, they completely surrounded Berlin. The British were something like 50 miles away.
Yeah, well, I mean, also Reinhard Gehlen, who used to head up the Gestapo in Eastern Europe, becomes the head of the BND, the follow-on West German intelligence service. And real Nazis, some of them were, some scapegoats were scapegoated at Nuremberg, but lots of people, and it wasn't just the scientists, we're talking about the intelligence officers, were integrated into NATO's initial structures from the get-go. And they were the in Germany and Italy, the fascists became the foot soldiers of the Gladio networks, which then engaged in assassination, murder, false flag terrorism to prevent left-wing governments from coming to power in Western Europe.
The key person on the Nazi side involved in these talks with the Allies was a guy called Martin Bormann. And he was Hitler's secretary. He was actually previously the secretary to Rudolf Hess. And when Hess went on his bogus peace mission to Britain, which didn't work out in 1941, so Bormann gained an enormous amount of power, eventually becoming Hitler's secretary. So let's have a listen now to this clip from a documentary. It's called Hitler's Henchman, and it's really where it's described the situation in the bunker right at the very end of the war. We're talking about the 30th of April, the 1st of May 1945. Bormann is Hitler's secretary in the bunker.
Berlin was encircled. There was a bloody battle for every inch of soil. An enemy radio station announced that Himmler was negotiating with the Allies. Bormann wrote,
"Others believe they must act out of superior understanding. They sacrifice the Führer. Shame on them. Their honor is disloyalty."
Even in the face of death, he knew no mercy. Shortly afterwards, he called for his secretary. Hitler dictated his will. The private will and testament of the millionaire Hitler.
All that I own goes to the party, should this no longer exist, to the state. Should the state also have been destroyed, no further decision is necessary. As executor of my will, I appoint my most loyal party comrade, Martin Bormann.
Dönitz was appointed Hitler's successor. Bormann was to become party minister. The shadow man wasn't suited to being a Führer. Without Hitler, he was nothing. In the bunker, waiting for the death of the tyrant.
There were also false trails being laid, Martin, weren't there? False trails being laid. Yeah. One to Greece and one to Kiel. So various people were thinking, well, where has he gone?
Outside the bunker, farewell. Bormann was finished. Bormann was disoriented. Others had taken command.
Soldat der deutschen Wehrmacht. Unser Führer Adolf Hitler ist gefallen. In tiefster Trauer und Ehrfurcht verneigt sich das deutsche Volk.
No one shed tears for him. At 2 o'clock in the morning, four men clambered out of a cellar window of the Reich Chancellery, Bormann among them. He struggled his way as far as the Weidendamm Bridge.
But the question, I suppose, Martin, is what happened there? Because it's interesting, these false trails, one to Greece, one to Kiel. Apparently, Bormann was with Dönitz, but of course he wasn't. And there was quite a lot of effort put into confusing everyone as to where he'd actually gone. And it really wasn't until 1996 that there was any kind of certainty about what had happened, even though Bormann's presence in South America was pretty well known and recognised and written about. How he'd got there really wasn't understood at all.
Well, as you know, the key book in all of this is Op JB by John Ainsworth Davis, or Creighton, I can't remember what pseudonym he used, and he basically sorry, sneezing. He basically was in command of the unit that went into Berlin and basically extracted Bormann so that he could live to fight another day, as it were. And, of course, one of the things they did was take somebody who had the same dental records as Bormann, and they were executed so that the body would be found, with this is Bormann, with his, because this is before DNA testing and so on. Now, the people, if they're interested, should get that book. It's on the internet, and anybody can read it. And,
it's not been published in the States, but it
no.
has here. I mean,
and, of course, it's got letters in that book, photocopies of letters in that book from Ian Fleming, who was the line manager for John Ainsworth Davis, from Mountbatten, and from Churchill, all saying, yes, you, when we're dead, you can tell people what you were doing. Because what they thought they were doing was they were rescuing Bormann from inside.
See, for Paul Manning, back in the 1980s, yeah. writing his book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, and the others, they assumed that this was a Nazi operation.
Yeah, well, in actual fact, it wasn't. It was an MI6 operation or something similar, deeper organisation than MI6.
Let's just be really clear here, because it's something called M-section yeah. of MI6. It's yeah. not part of the Ministry of Defence. It's funded directly by King George VI.
Yeah, so in other words, what's going on here, there was a back channel between the very senior people on the British and American side and very senior people on the Nazi side to stitch up the end of the war. And that, of course, then led to the creation of the Gladio networks in Western Europe, which were the ones that carried out the bombings and shootings in Italy and Belgium and other places in the 1970s, 1950s and onwards. So, in other words, the linkages between these Nazi personnel and the Western intelligence services goes back at least that far,
okay,
and quite possibly to the 1930s.
Okay, what about the link to the Kennedy assassination? Because I was quite fascinated to hear that George H.W. Bush was actually James Files, who is the mafia hitman from Chicago, that actually shot, killed Kennedy, basically blew his brains out in Dealey Plaza from the grassy knoll. He identifies George H.W. Bush as being part of the CIA at that time. So, yeah. I mean, do you think that's credible?
Yes.
Anyway, Bush. Let's have a listen now before we finish to James Files talking about Bush in the CIA.
George Herbert Bush, I don't know, a lot of people ain't going to believe this, but he worked for the CIA back as early as 1961 that I know of.
How did he work for him? What did he do?
I don't know what all he did, but he did a lot of recruiting work. I know he was there at the beginning for what we call Group 40, Special Operations Group, Group 40. And if you wonder what Group 40 was, Assassination Group.
Do you have any proof of what you've told us in regards to the Kennedy assassination?
And it gets down to this part about a lot of people ask a lot of different questions about things. The one thing that I could verify right now, which cannot be made public, is the ledger, diary, ledger, whichever you prefer to call it, is a book with some papers and things that Sheriff Nicoletti gave to me before he was killed. Things got pretty active here. Sam Giancana was the first one to be killed, and that was in 75. And I'm not sure, maybe September. It was 75. Go there. He was killed. And the night he was killed, Johnny Roselli was in town. But I saw Johnny Roselli at the airport. And when Johnny Roselli come in, we didn't talk or anything. I was there to pick somebody else up to come in on that flight just by coincidence. And I was picking up a party that I did a lot of work for, collecting money and things. But anyway, I seen Johnny. We just nodded each other. He had another man with him. When they left, we was right behind them. They got in their vehicle outside. We got in our, we took off. We went down the road. We went down River Road, proceeding south. And the kid with me said, the only place Johnny could be going would be going over to see Sam. Fifth Avenue on River Road there in Belmont, they had a place they called the Blue Horizon. Johnny pulled in there momentarily, let the guy with him out. Whoever this guy was, he wasn't going to Sam's house because Sam didn't like a lot of people coming to his house, and if he didn't know them, they wasn't going to get in anyway. And Johnny went on. I went my way. Johnny Roselli went his. Johnny Roselli, the next morning I woke up, Sam Giancana had been executed gangland style. When he was killed, bells went off of me. Johnny Roselli had to be the one to do it because he was there. I know he went to Sam's house that night. The following year, Johnny Roselli was killed. When Johnny Roselli was killed, the party, I figure it's the same guy that he probably dropped off. There was two people killed down there in Tampa, St. Pete, there in that area that was got rid of at the same time. One was Johnny Roselli. The other one, another party unknown, whoever it was. I don't remember the name of him now, but evidently, it was a friend of his that had traveled to Chicago with him. I figured he knew something, and somebody took him out, too, because they knew that Johnny Roselli, what have you done, okay? This guy, he might have told this guy knew they got rid of him. And when it comes down to it, the crime family did not have Sam Giancana killed. I don't know who killed him except for Johnny Roselli there, but I believe that the government ordered the contract killing on Sam Giancana. I believe the government is the one that killed Johnny Roselli to shut him up so he couldn't talk.
All of this was about the time of the House Select Committee on Assassination.
All of it, yes.
So
the
you
following
think
year.
That was the tie-in?
Pardon me?
Roselli,
oh, definitely.
Giancana.
But anybody that knew Sam Giancana, they knew Sam Giancana would have never talked. He'd have went to jail. He'd have kept his mouth shut. He would not talk. The following year, Johnny Roselli, he got killed. That silenced him. And then in March 29th, this the night that Charles Nicoletti was killed. And he was supposed to go testify before some committee. And he was killed at the Golden Horns right there in Melrose Park there on North Avenue and Manheim Road, the Golden Horns restaurant. And I thought at first maybe somebody in the family had hit him because we knew there was trouble. And right before his death, he'd give me this package and told me, he said, this is my life insurance. He said, if I need it, I want you to have it, you can always get to it. He said, and if anything happens to me, he says, you might need it someday. So what he gave me was, I took it and I went out, got me some cheesecloth, I wrapped a little package up and I put a little metal box. I went out and I dug a hole and I buried it, put it away and covered it all up. So about a week and a half later, you know, Chuck was killed. After he was killed, right after that, maybe another week, 10 days later, I had two places on Lake Street there in Melrose Park. One was a restaurant called the Coffee Cup. It's no longer there. It's been closed down. They put a parking lot there for the Westlake Hospital. And right down below it, going east on the following block down there, which had been the 1100 block, I had a club there, a social club. And what that was, we did bookmaking there. We had card games there. We had a couple of pool tables in there. And that's where a lot of the guys come there and hung out at. We didn't have any booze there. We didn't have any women there. What we did, you wanted to gamble, you come there and you gamble. You come there and you hung out to be with the guys. But when people come to the club there to gamble and play, I didn't charge them or nothing. I wanted something, I call a restaurant up. So this is about 11 o'clock, 11:30 that night. I called up to the restaurant, and I told my grill man, a guy called Gorilla, is fixing me up a couple dozen hamburgers, and fries, a dozen black coffees, and get it ready. And he said, hey, boss, let me bring it down to the club. You crazy. Stay where you're at. Stay in the restaurant. You don't belong down there. Stay up there. Because Gorilla, he loved to come down there and hang out and gamble and everything else. And I had him working behind the grill. I said, when you get it fixed, give me a buzz when it's ready to be picked up. He said, okay, boss. Because he always called me boss. Got ready, called back down the club. Say, hey, boss, it's ready. You going to pick it up? I said, I'll run it down if you want. I said, nah, don't worry. Come and get it. So put it in a box. So he had a cardboard box. He put it in. Be ready to go. So like always, we've done this many times, time after time after time. There's nothing unusual about it, you know. So I walk out of the club. It's a nice night out, you know. So I walk down to the corner, and the car's coming down off the side street onto Lake Street. Well, it comes up, does like, you know, rocking for a Hollywood stop. Comes up the stop sign and stops, hits the brakes, and kind of rocks back. I step back up on the curb so I don't get run over. I'm thinking nothing about it. It's nonchalantly, you know. The next thing I know, somebody sticks something out the window, and I got sprayed in the face. And I hit the ground. Now I don't remember falling down. When I come to, I was strapped up, tied up, blindfolded. And I went through a pretty severe torture test. And all this here has been verified also. What they wanted the ledger. They never got it. When they got through with me, my legs were still taped together. My arms and wrists were still taped behind my back. They threw me out of a car out there in Elmhurst. People found me. They called the cops up. Police come out there. Some of them recognized me. Everybody in town, as long as I've been missing, everybody figured I was dead.
When they threw you out of the car, do you think they thought you were dead?
Oh, they thought I was dead, definitely. Otherwise, they'd have never left me alive. That's why I've always blamed the FBI for it. Because the family or the CIA, they would have a couple of holes in the back of my head and four or five inside the mouth through the palate, gangland execution style. These people, they didn't do that. When I lost consciousness and couldn't be brought back, evidently they figured I was dead. They didn't even bother to untape me or nothing. I was still naked. They threw me out of the car in the nude. Ankles still taped, hands behind my back, everything still taped up. And so the Elmhurst police, they knew who I was. They picked me up. They took me in to their place, wanted to put me in the hospital. They took me over to the emergency room, as a matter of fact. And then they made a couple of phone calls and notified my wife. And my wife had a heart attack because as soon as she answered the phone, they said, Elmhurst police, Ms. Files, we have found your husband. And when she said that, she just knew that I was dead, you know. So she broke down. She got all hysterical. Her mother was there. Then they got a hold of Gorilla, and they all come out there to get me. They took me home. They would put me in the hospital. I said, no, I'm not going to no hospital. So they take me home. I couldn't even talk. I'm writing notes. I want to go home. I want to go home. I'm scrabbling it out on paper. My throat, I had screamed so much, I had no voice left. And so Gorilla, he's sitting in the house with me. Because if I had to go to the bathroom, he'd pick me up and carry me to the bathroom. And he's sitting there. I got a Remington Model A 70 on the side of his stamp, law enforcement only, folding stock, 8 rounds in it. I had a gun car in the driveway, one on each end of the block. Some of the Broadview police, they said, man, you need help. I said, we'll cover you. We'll park our cars at this. No, I got my own guys here. Don't worry about it. Just don't let nobody mess with them. They said, we got you covered. Your guys are okay. Don't worry about it. So over the next 3 days, like 4 days, until I get to where I could talk again, Gorilla stayed there at the house with me. He didn't even go home. And they never got the ledger. That's still missing. Not missing. I know where it is. And let me clarify one thing. Nobody in the world knows where that is but me. It's right here. Nobody else can ever take them to it.
Still your insurance policy.
And still it. And if I die, all those secrets in that book go to my grave with
now
me.
Now, what's all in that little package? It's a little box,
it's
right?
A little box, little package inside cheesecloth, inside a metal box.
What's in there?
What is in there? In this side this here, this ledger, what they want. I got a few other things in there, but what they want is this ledger, because it's got every, just about basically every murder that was carried out in the Chicagoland area. It's got dates, it's got names, figures of money, different things, reasons why. People who ordered it.
Anything in there about the JFK hit?
You've got, there's a couple little lines in there. It's got JFK down. It's got the date on it. Basically, that's it.
Anything else in there that concerns the assassination?
No, just that. Just the date and the name and everything, but it's all in Chuck's own handwriting. What was in the package was I disposed of a lot of it, like Secret Service identification. I didn't need that. I disposed of the little map, the last minute change. That was irrelevant. I burned all that stuff. I've got rid of all that. The only thing I kept was the ledger. The ledger pertained basically to the contracts from around town, local people, people that was paid, people that was hit, the dates, when it happened, and sometimes the reason why.
Well, why would the FBI care about all that?
Oh, they'd love that because they could put a lot of people in jail.
And they could clear a lot of cases.
Oh, they could have cleared a lot of cases. They could close the door on a lot of murder cases. I'm going to say probably somewhere in the neighborhood of maybe 60 contract killings in Chicago over the years there.
So this is actually hitmen in the Chicago Mafia being used to kill the Chicago Mafia boss, Martin. But, of course, the point here is everybody involved in the Kennedy assassination who was actually knew who'd killed and why and how was being killed in the mid-1970s.
Yeah. I mean, this is a very murky world, and as you know, these kind of people do these kind of things. And the idea that we have a democracy is rather laughable when you know more about it.
I mean, is it a stretch to connect George W. Bush, a senior, James Files, the Kennedy assassination, to this stuff in the Hitler bunker?
George H.W. Bush was in Dallas. Well, it certainly is, because Prescott Bush was arrested by Roosevelt in the war. Prescott, this is the grandfather, and he was arrested for dealing with the enemy, because in actual fact, Western, U.S. military, U.S. oligarchs were very, very influential in the Nazi movement and were involved in big investments in Germany. And so in other words, the links between these right-wing groups in the West and the Nazis go back to the 1930s.
So we're hearing 1961, George H.W. Bush, who eventually became president, was actually running something called Group 40, which is a code word in the CIA for their International Assassination Squad.
Yeah, well, the Bush family have been involved. I mean, Prescott Bush was involved in an attempted coup against Roosevelt, which was grassed up by General Smedley Butler, who's the former head of the U.S. Marine Corps. People think this is all crazy. This is all checkable. Just put in the names on the internet and you will find all of this information.
On your favorite search engine, not necessarily Google. Well, time to sign off now for the US-owned Comcast News at 8, thanks to our guests in the first hour. Brexit Party candidate for North Somerset, Anne Tarr, retired teacher also, and South West NUT rep Nina Franklin, and Irish Republican Labour activist you just heard there, Martin Summers. And you can download our MP3s and listen in the car anywhere you like. You'll find this show's podcast, story links and comment page, and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Our sister show Dialects here next Tuesday at noon, but do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless. And don't let the banksters get you down.
Two, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.